Among those who fell were two sons of Darius and a brother, and then Leonidas himself. A desperate struggle, fittingly Homeric, was fought over the dead king's body, until the Spartans, in the ferocity of their anguish and despair, hauled it back to temporary safety. But then from behind them, just above the eastern exit from the hot gates, there came the glinting of spear tips amid the scrub of the slope. The immortals had arrived. Menaced from all sides now, the surviving Greeks retreated back beyond the wall, aiming for a small hillock in the shadow of the middle gate. There, although the Thebans, separated from their fellows and forced against the cliff face, never reached it, the Spartans and the Thespians made their final stand. Feathered with arrows, slathered with gore, they resisted to the end. Even when their swords shivered, they used the hilts as knuckle dusters, or else fought with their teeth, their fists, their nails. Only when every last Spartan and Thespian lay dead, the dust blood-slaked, the corpses piled high, could the struggle be reckoned over and the pass the great kings at last. Xerxes himself, entering the hot gates at around midday, was both elated by the sight of Persian banners fluttering over the battlefield and revolted by the carnage. As was his duty to the men who had fallen in his cause, he gave instructions for trenches to be dug and the bodies of his dead to be laid in them, then reverently covered with earth and leaves. He left the corpses of the Greeks to rot, while those few Thebans who had chosen to fling down their weapons rather than be slaughtered, he ordered to be chained and branded. That he was in no mood for magnanimity was hardly surprising, for despite his brilliant success in destroying, after only 2.5 days fighting, the Greeks' seemingly impregnable position, it had been no part of his battle plan that so many of the defenders should escape annihilation. Another pinprick was soon to come, for the Greek fleet, it was reported to him the following afternoon, had staged its own successful evacuation, having skulked away in the dead of night to safer waters. The Persian fleet, crossing to Artemisium in the morning, had found nothing of the enemy save for the smoking embers of campfires and the well-gnawed bones of cattle. Fugitives the Greeks may have been, humiliated by land and sea, but it seemed that they were still resolved to carry on the fight. Yet surely now it would not be long before they would have their necks wrung like chickens. The cities of Boeotia were scurrying to open their gates to the conqueror, and though the great king's squadrons may have been storm-battered, a way to boost their spirits was conveniently close. A formal invitation was issued to the fleet. Leave to go and see how King Xerxes deals with lunatics who think that they can beat him. So many men took up this offer, it is said, that there were not enough boats to ferry them all to the hot gates. More than the corpses of the Greeks, more than the piles of helmets with their horsehair crests, hacked and dented, more even than those badges of the Spartans' pride, their blood-red cloaks and tunics, now nothing but tattered rags, one trophy, shocking and hideous, would certainly have brought home to Ionian sailors the full awful scale of their master's power. Driven into the side of the road was a stake, and driven onto the top of the stake was a human head. Although it was normally the custom of the Persians, more than any other people in the world, to honour men who distinguish themselves in war, no honour had been shown Leonidas, king of a city accursed. What better fate had he deserved? And the sightless eyeballs of the allied commander-in-chief, shrunken already and crawled across by flies, were fixed upon the road that led to Athens, now open and defenceless.